Live from a sweatshop deep inside the bowels of Burbank, California, it's the Mark Maron Show. And now, his exits are not clearly marked. Mark Maron.
Oh, thank you, Jim. Little Jimmy Earl on the mic. Geniuses, philosopher kings, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives, need machines, and, of course, you pain sponges and broken puppets. How are you? We welcome all. This is the land of misfit toys. This is the world of the unwanted people. Welcome. Welcome aboard. That's what we're running here.
It's the land of broken people.
Yeah, that's right. The land of the broken people. And I'm proud to be a broken person, though I wish I was a little better off in some areas, Jim. You know what I'm going to do tonight, Jim?
What's that?
Which I don't usually do. I'm going to set up the show right at the beginning. Oh. How do you like that?
Oh, man, I don't know. Okay,
there's an outside chance we're going to be preempted by women's basketball tonight, so I figured I'd get this out of the way because only the podcasters will most likely be able to hear it. If not, welcome aboard, Sparks fans. I think we might actually have a shot at the Sparks fans. I'm not sure about the Clippers fans, but I think the Sparks fans might be up our alley. You know what I'm saying?
Maybe so.
I'm not sure what I mean by that. I'm just saying that...
You lost them.
Women's issues.
With that sexual innuendo.
Well, I did?
Mm-hmm.
Which one?
With the up your alley thing.
Who the hell made that sexy?
You did.
No, I didn't. I said, if that's up your alley, that's not a sexual innuendo by nature. That's just a saying. It's like, hey, which road do I go down? Let's go up this alley.
My mistake. My mistake.
I'll say, where's your brain at, Mr. Dirty Pants?
Where it should be. I'm not ashamed.
Of what? Being a Mr. Dirty Pants?
My sexuality.
What the hell has this got to do with your sexuality?
We're talking about broken people.
Broken people, your sexuality, up your alley, apparently triggered all this.
You're good with talking points. It's very good. You'd be a good note taker.
I was not a good note taker. And I did make some notes this evening. Let me tell you some of those notes about who's going to be on the show. Is that okay, Jim?
It's fine with me. I was waiting for you.
Is that up your alley? Tell me if these are up your alley. J.R. Norton, Jim Norton, as we called him around the office. You remember Jim? Author of Saving General Washington. Funny guy. Used to work for Franken. Remember back in the day, the old days when...
I don't remember him at all.
When you were wandering around the halls going, this is thievery! Thievery!
What, that was then?
Yeah, back that far. That was before Franken buttressed himself into that studio, or into that office area in the corner where no one could get at it. Also, Kirsten Powers, Democratic strategist, going to be on the phone. She's a DNC-sanctioned Democratic strategist, whatever that means. That means we're going to get some fresh talking points. Yeah, I know. You can go right on the blog and see her. Yes, that's her. She looks like a Democratic. She looks like a Washington, a woman Washington operative.
You know what? She also looks hot.
Is she up your alley? Yeah. Shyla Dewan, our favorite, one of my favorite guests from the New York Times. She's the Southern Beat reporter, going to give us a lowdown on the Gulf Coast in just a few minutes. Let's do some jokes, man. I don't want you to be uninformed or off guard or any of that. So we've got the first edition of the Mark Maron Show Short Order News right here, right now. U.S. weather experts predict there could be up to 16 tropical storms in the Atlantic Ocean this hurricane season. When asked if he thought El Nino would cause the storms, President Bush said he hoped not, but he would still give him temporary worker status anyway. Yeah. All right. The personal data on up to 26.5 million military veterans was stolen from the home of a Department of Veterans Affairs employee. Observers say this is a very unusual occurrence because generally when something bad happens to massive numbers of veterans, the government denies it. Mm. Experts say the names and social security numbers would be gold for identity thieves, especially if they were trying to get substandard health care. Workers at a British factory making French fries were evacuated 2 days running last week after bomb parts turned up in potatoes imported from the site of battles in World War I and World War II. Later, after inspecting the food, several fast food chains reported shrapnel in one of its rats. Wow, was that the joke I wanted to do? Health inspectors said the workers were lucky that nobody pulled the pins on the potatoes. One employee was nearly killed had it not been for his buddy who dove on top of a potato.
Oh, man, these are great.
I know. Huh? Steven Spielberg is planning to make a movie about it called Saving Private Fryin'. Huh?
Mm-hmm.
Huh?
Mm-hmm.
You know what that's from? Thanks. That's a shorter news version one. Do you remember that? Do you know what that laugh's from? You know what just triggered that in my head? Alvy, the universe is not going to expand for many thousands of more years. It's a psychiatrist in Annie Hall from the flashback sequence from when his family lived in Coney Island under the roller coaster.
Man.
Eh? Well, Nichols. See? Nichols. See? Nichols.
Wow.
I know. Weird flashback. Weird flashback. Look, I don't care what anybody says. I think it's very practical. If you want to save money in the day and age we live in now, put it in the freezer. I don't care if it's $10,000 or $90,000. The mattress, the freezer. I mean, it's better than the bank account. It's better than perhaps investing in the stock market. So when Representative William Jefferson, Democratic from Louisiana, whatever that money was from, even he accepted it to bribe perhaps a Nigerian official, perhaps not. He's not pleading to anything right yet. But I say, you know, put it in the freezer. I'm thinking about putting my money in the freezer. I don't care what anyone says. When you look at the news, and but first of all, let me tell you one thing about this guy Jefferson, all right? Given the fact that, look how many Republican congressmen are under real indictment for screwing over this country.
Mm-hmm.
That are not to be given the treatment this guy gets. The FBI went to his office in the House of Representatives. That is an unprecedented move in the history of the House of Representatives, to the point where people like Denny Hastert and John Boehner, Republican, majority leader and whip, is that right? House Speaker and the majority leader at this point in time, we're saying, like, that's crazy. You know why? They can't let this president be set because they might go through their stuff. Why aren't they going through all the Republicans that are causing, you know, committing real crimes? It was stupid and heinous. But bottom line, put the cash in the refrigerator because I got some inside information. A report from Barclays Capital says that the run-up to the 1987 stock market crash was characterized by a widening U.S. current account deficit, weak dollar, fears of rising inflation, a fading boom in American house prices, and the appointment of a new chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. Sound familiar? Yes, just like now. Put your money in the freezer. Jefferson was a smart man, maybe a little corrupt, but a smart man.
$500,000 now.
Is that it's up to?
But yeah, the bribery, $500,000.
But wait, not in his freezer. They only had it.
No, I don't know what
$90,000.
I couldn't read the rest. You know,
$400,000 or so.
Yeah, that's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money.
Maybe Rove isn't dumb enough to keep his money in his freezer. That's the thing.
I don't know. Is Rove up for bribery?
Oh, come on. If he isn't, he should be.
Shiloh Dewan, he's not. He's a conspiracy. Treason. Perjury. Obstructing justice. Shiloh Dewan on the Gulf in a minute.
And now he's got $500,000 in his fanny pack. Mark Maron.
I got another 200 G's in the freeze, my friend. In the freezer. Hey, people, Ray Nagin has been reelected mayor of New Orleans thanks to the displaced people of his city. Hurricane season is upon us and the levees aren't ready. FEMA is getting sued and Shiloh Dewan, the New York Times reporter for the South, is on it and with us. Welcome back to the show, Shiloh.
Hi, Mark.
Nice to have you. So, Ray Nagin won back the job of mayor for New Orleans by 4 percentage points. Were you surprised?
I personally was not surprised.
Really? Why?
I wish I had sent myself a letter.
Uh-huh.
I may have said early on that I wouldn't have thought he would win. But
yeah.
As the election approached, I was talking to a lot of New Orleanians,
mm-hmm.
a lot of evacuees. And the more people I talked to, the less I heard Mitch Landrieu's name. That was his opponent. And
right.
People just seemed to be more comfortable with Nagin.
Did you take bets around the office?
I wish.
No, you didn't. You were the only one that thought he would win, huh?
No, but my editor called me and said, you can tell me you told me so.
Now, why do you think, is it because this is an interesting case. This is a guy that was there that you would have thought it could have gone either way, like he would have either been blamed for botching something up, or now it seems that people were comfortable that he was there, and he was many of them must have felt he was looking out for them, and at least he is familiar with the situation.
Well, there's a lot to do with race here,
mm-hmm.
And there's a lot to do with Nagin's personality. He
right.
is just an extremely charismatic man
mm-hmm.
who knows his own weaknesses and admits them up front. So people like that.
Do you think it had anything to do with the plan he's put in place for the city? I mean, that's gotten some press down there that in the last couple of months, he's now they're doing tests and drills and things, and he initiated some sort of evacuation plan for the city.
I don't think that people are that engrossed in the details of the plan for the city. I mean, I think in terms of substance, he and Mitchell Andrew were fairly close.
Is he a good guy for the job?
No comment.
Got it. What is the status of the displaced population at this point? I mean, apparently you reported that a lot of them came in to vote. Are many of them beginning to move back? Is there any momentum since I've last talked to you?
No, a lot of them still have nothing to come back to.
Mm.
I mean, there are just thousands and thousands of people out there who want to come home but can't. I think the longer it takes, the more people will settle in where they are. I'm still hearing, you know, people are saying, well, I'm going to go back in 2009.
2009?
Yeah.
Wow, do they know something we don't? Is that is that the year it's supposed to all be beautiful again?
I guess so.
Oh, my God.
I guess they think it couldn't possibly be any sooner than that.
But obviously, a lot of them have still their hearts and their minds and the future invested in the city. How many of them traveled back to vote for Nagin?
We don't know. There's no way of telling that because there's no way to count it.
Right, right.
They voted in New Orleans for Nagin. They were not counted as an absentee vote.
Okay, so what about the absentee votes? Were they high?
The absentee votes were 24,000, I believe. They're a little higher than in the primary.
Wow, that's a lot. That's a lot. It seems to me that that's a lot for any mayoral race, period.
I would say, well, it's a lot higher than their normal absentee vote, I can tell you that.
Right. Now, let's talk about the last time you talked to us, you said FEMA was trying to push some people out of their temporary housing that they had been promised for a year. What's going on with that?
It's still happening. There's been a lawsuit filed. FEMA is also now doing the same thing with trailers.
Mm-hmm.
They have, as you may know, about 10,000 empty trailers in Arkansas.
Right, just sitting there.
Mobile homes, but
yeah.
Nevertheless, they're going ahead and notifying 3,000 people in Mississippi that they need to move out of their trailers.
And this is outside of, this is before the time limit they've promised, right?
Well, I mean, it's not clear exactly what they promised, but what is clear is that the vast majority of people in these trailers believed, for whatever reason, that they had them for 18 months.
Okay. Now, in terms of moving towards rebuilding, is there have you seen any momentum, any progress in the last month or what have you?
You know, I haven't spent a lot of time in the city in the past month, and I think, frankly, everyone was very distracted by the election. There were debates almost every night, it seemed like, in New Orleans, and there was a real sense that after the election, we can finally really get going on this. No money is really expected to hit the ground until August, as I understand it.
Wow. So that, I know when I was there, it was like it seemed like everyone was running. It seemed like there was posters for everybody. The guy who ran the zoo was running for mayor.
Yes. And now here we are, back with the person we started with.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I guess. I think that people, not unlike, you know, the presidency, if you believe that was actually a fair election of any sort, that, you know, people feel like whoever went through the worst of it with them is there for better or for worse. I don't know. There's a report out from the Independent Levy Investigation Team that basically holds Congress responsible for not funding the Army Corps of Engineers properly to address the problem. So now, on June 1st, we start hurricane season again. They're expecting several storms. What do you think, how are they going to handle this? How are they preparing? Do you have any idea?
Well, you know, they're going through a lot of motions of preparing, but I think that we're going to have to see what happens when the first storm hits, unfortunately. That's not very comforting to people in the hurricane zone. But as far as the levees go, I mean, there are certainly some levees in New Orleans that will be much stronger than they were before, whether they're strong enough.
Who knows?
I'm not sure.
Well, they're actually saying that it's not going to be that bad, whatever that means. How could they really know that stuff? I think they're just saying that to make people feel better down there. Don't you hear? It's just sort of like, yeah, it's going to be okay. Not so bad this year, we're thinking. I mean, how could it get any worse than it did last year, right?
Right.
That's unbelievable.
It's all what your point of reference is.
So, but on some level, I guess these drills that they're running, I mean, they're still what? What 75% of the people of New Orleans are still gone, right?
About, yes. Well, I think between 50 and 75% are gone.
So it's just by virtue of the numbers, this season seems like if something really bad happens, it can't be the chaos it was last year just by virtue of the fact that no one's there anymore.
Well, at least in New Orleans it can't.
But. Right. What's going on with the other areas in Texas and in where Mississippi?
Well, one thing that people are worried about is that there are a lot of trailers and mobile homes out there that people are living in for hurricane season. It's not clear what's going to happen. to those.
I just had a sort of, I think, probably a wrong thought that they should make them houseboats, that the mobile homes should, they should just make them all equipped to float. I mean, is that wrong? Is that a bad thought? I don't know.
maybe if they did that and move them to the Great Lakes.
Yeah, let's just abandon the whole project down there. Now, just out of curiosity, from your poking around down there in New Orleans, do you think that they're, what's going on with the real estate market? Are they going to upgrade the entire city to like a Disneylandish condo type of situation there on the water, or is there momentum towards that?
I think that's another thing which has been really up in the air, and I don't think anyone's really looked closely at what kind of deals developers are hammering out now.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, you know, Nagin has walked that fence about which neighborhoods are going to be rebuilt, which ones are going to be green space, and which ones they're going to attempt to buy up into a land trust and then presumably turn over to developers.
Right. So none of that has really been decided. Time will tell on that one.
I mean, it's hard for me to imagine New Orleans becoming a Disney World, but...
Yeah, well, you know, it's what scares me is that they could do something in a thematic vein that would just completely suck the life out of what the place represented. I think that's a fear of a lot of people down there.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Shyla, thanks for talking to us. Have a good vacation.
All right, thanks.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
That was Shyla Dewan from the New York Times talking about the Gulf region, Jim. I want to go back to New Orleans. I think I'd like to maybe buy a place there. How would that be?
Okay,
I'll be down there with Harry Shearer.
First, you should do some research before I would buy anything. I would get some, you know, high hill ground, possibly on bedrock.
What don't you? Why can't I be in the thick of it? Why can't I be facing the storm and being there for the people? I have faith in the future of the city, and I'm not lying. It's a great city.
I'm sure it's a great city, but I don't think like what about 10-20% of it shouldn't be where it is.
Yeah, that's probably true.
It's like the San Joaquin Delta.
Yeah,
Sacramento area. Mm-hmm. It's just the whole thing is waiting for a huge.
I'll be honest with you. I'm thinking about just heading for the hills. I'm thinking about just getting out, period. I don't even know where the hell I'm going, but I'm tired of whatever the hell's going on. Is there any way I can completely disconnect from everything?
Sure. Yeah.
I'm sick of it.
San Bernardino Mountains.
Is that close I can go?
Yeah.
But I'm talking for a long time. I'm talking maybe forever. I'm thinking about splitting.
Spawn Ranch?
That doesn't even exist anymore. Spawn Ranch. What is it with you and your Manson and Hitler fantasies?
Hey, man, there was a great front line. It was American Experience last night.
Yeah.
On Goebbels.
Yeah. Goebbels?
Yeah.
He's the guy that wrote the book for Rove. Mm-hmm. Rove is drawing from the Goebbels handbook.
Absolutely.
Look, invest in ethanol or put your money in the freezer. We'll be back.
Now, John McCain thinks he's an idiot. Mark Maron.
I'm just happy to be getting attention. You know, folks, I really know very little about history, and that goes for last week, my friends. Now, when it comes to American history, I have a vague idea about a few things that are fairly finite and well-documented, but still not clear. To set us straight on some history that is constantly mischaracterized and exploited by the Republicans, that is what the Founding Fathers actually stood for, is a guy I used to see running around the halls of Air America back in the old days, J.R. Norton. His new book, Saving General Washington, is out now. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Thanks for having me on, Mark. Appreciate it.
I remember seeing you around Air America. Do you remember me?
I do. You did an Al Franken impression that I remember as being one of the best around.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I do that occasionally. It's better when you see it in person with the walk, with the weird old wrestling guy walk.
No, the walk is absolutely key, yeah.
So this book is very smart. It's very funny. It's got everything you need to know in it. It's compelling. It's up to date. Congratulations for writing a good book.
Well, thanks so much. You know, I just gave it my best shot.
Well, you're a very impressive guy. You're a guy that can sit down and write things that are smart and funny. That's a great gift. I'm sitting with a guy that does that too, right here, Jim.
Right on.
Hey, JR, how are you?
Yeah, there you go. That's
doing
nice.
Well. How are you?
I'm all right. How's it been going?
This segment's going aces. This is perfect. So, what are some of the most overused misrepresentations of history that the Republicans draw from and try to baffle and stupefy the American public? And mislead them, by the way.
Well, you know, in getting into the book, I've actually found that the problem is not so much the misrepresentation of the Founding Fathers, although that certainly happens often enough. You know, Rove has done it on more than one occasion in public. It's more a question of the legacy being completely forgotten and airbrushed over. One of the things I dug into as I started researching the book was looking through the White House website, which is a fairly comprehensive repository of all the sort of speeches and press conferences and other public goings-on of the Bush administration. So I just wanted to dig around and see, you know, how the Founding Fathers cropped up, how they were used, how they were sort of referenced and potentially abused. And just to give you kind of an example of scale, you know, George Washington, you know, thus far, 5.5 years in, was mentioned 314 times in sort of public discussions. Ronald Reagan came up twice as often, 648 times.
Huh.
Barney the dog, 862 times. Tom Paine, 0 times. And, you know, the rest of the Founding Fathers, Hamilton and Jefferson and Franklin and all those guys, were really just not much of a presence. And I think part of what's going on is that the legacy of the Founding Fathers, if you look into it, is sort of a stark contrast to the way government's been trending over the last 5 years.
And also, President Bush is assuming that his base might get lost when he starts throwing around the word Hamilton, Jefferson. You know, they're not as recognizable as the George Washington.
Yes, or the Ronald Reagans or Pat Robertsons or other figures who are really kind of the guiding lights of the administration currently in power.
So what were some of the principles? Now, settle this one for me, because I've asked many people. First, were the Founding Fathers a bunch of Masonic geniuses?
Geniuses, yes, and actually a number of them were members of the Masons. I wouldn't go too far in terms of saying they were geniuses because they were Masons, but you know, rather that's just sort of how you got to meet people and get ahead in society back then.
So that's interesting. It wasn't some sort of creepy conspiracy. It was just a way to meet people and who think the same way and maybe organize a little bit of a revolution, perhaps.
Yeah, precisely. And if you look at the sort of the principles that revolution revolved around, you know, I would really break it up into either what I would call progressive principles, and there was a lot of ideas regarding, you know, free press, freedom of expression, human rights, concern for the public welfare, and libertarian principles, checks and balances, a limited government, an executive branch that had some accountability, search and seizure being regulated by the Constitution, things like this. And what we're seeing, or what we have been seeing over the past, like I said, particularly since September 11th, mm-hmm. is a government that's been trending in an authoritarian direction, which is pretty much in the direction of King George. And if you look at the rhetoric of what the Founding Fathers wrote and what they were passionate about and what they were excited about, it was about battling the authoritarian power of their day.
So we're talking to J.R. Norton. The book is Saving General Washington. One thing I didn't hear you say in that list of things that you did find as tenets and principles around that revolution was religion, which seems to be being, you know, bandied about quite frequently by this administration and by people who believe that religion should be part of our government in terms of perhaps making the Constitution the Bible or replacing it. So how did they feel about God?
Well, there was a lot of real respect both for God as an abstract concept and for religion as a social good among the Founding Fathers. They weren't some of them were religious, a lot of them were deists, which is a belief in some sort of higher power, but without a lot of church going and what they might term superstition.
Maybe not a beard.
Probably not a beard.
Mm-hmm.
And they're, you know, very much in opposition to, say, the Puritans before them. And the thing that a lot of people don't know about the Founding Fathers and the Constitution specifically is when the Constitution came out, it was savaged by the religious right of the 18th century. There was a pamphleteer named Aristocratus, which is his pen name, and he wrote, "The new Constitution disdains belief of a deity, the immortality of the soul, or the resurrection of the body, a day of judgment, or a future state of rewards and punishment."
Mm.
It was seen as a godless document, and rightly so, because the Founding Fathers thought, you know, the best way to protect religion is to keep it out of government. They were familiar with what happened when you mixed religion and government in Europe. And what you get is religion becoming an extension of power. Religion becomes a way to move money around, a way to get marshal public support, whether marshaling voters or just bringing the mob out in your favor. And it has a really corrupting influence on the public discourse, and they knew that.
Well, now how does this stuff mutate? I mean, this doesn't happen overnight. This doesn't happen for one administration. I mean, in terms of the separation of church and state, and in terms of, I recently heard that the Second Amendment has nothing to do with really the right of individual citizens, owning handguns or semi-automatic weapons. It was pretty specific to militias. Yet this is sort of morphed because of lobbyists and political opportunists into a misrepresentation of what the Constitution and perhaps what the Founding Fathers stood for.
Well, I think it morphs because of political convenience, and that political convenience is aided and abetted by nobody knowing anything about history. And to be perfectly frank, I really didn't know an incredible amount about American history before I went into this project. I was reading Ron Chernow's biography of Alexander Hamilton, which is really a fabulous book. I recommend to anyone. And what caught my eye as I read about Hamilton and I read about Franklin and Washington and all those guys, I'm like, these guys are progressives. I can identify with what they're saying and what they're doing, and it really struck a chord for me. And it just seemed that you can take what the Founding Fathers did in the public sphere and the reasons that they fought the Revolution, and kind of put that up against the canvas of what the Bush administration has done and how they've changed American government. And the contrast would be interesting.
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the stuff that you show historically in the book. Like, you talk about the difference between loyalty to the people and loyalty to political masters. And you talk about cronyism. And that has always been part of an American politics, right?
Well, cronyism is always a part of politics in any society, in any time. And, it rises and falls. I think what really changes are sort of public perceptions of cronyism and what it means, and the leadership's attitude toward it, whether they're actively trying to root it out or they're tolerant of it or that's the way they get things done. Washington, in his first inaugural, had this great quote where he said, "We should seek to find men who are best qualified to fill offices, but never give our consent to the creation of offices to accommodate men." And he really lived that. He would be petitioned by family members interested in getting government jobs, and Jefferson too, and they would turn them away because that's not how things were done. That's how things were done under the British system, which was viewed by the revolutionaries as corrupt. In contrast, that with Michael Brown at FEMA, you probably remember, got his job because he was college roommates with a Republican operative.
And you call him the crony extraordinaire in the book.
He's just the poster boy, for cronyism and the dangers that it poses. What happens when you put your federal disaster agency in the hands of a guy who happens to be pals with a guy who's high up in the party? And well, you get the response to Hurricane Katrina, and you get things like, I'm not sure if you remember this, but White House press spokesman Ari Fleischer's brother Michael, despite not having any real qualifications, was named the top aide for Iraqi private sector development under Bremer, and he had the gall to talk about the Iraqi system and say the only paradigm they know is cronyism. I mean,
the shamelessness and doublespeak of this administration is mind-blowing, and I have to assume, to tie it all up, after all the research you did, and in terms of what you understand the Founding Fathers to have stood for in the beginning of this country and what democracy is supposed to stand for, is there a way to salvage our system of government?
I think that, everything is fluid, and we've seen so many bad effects in terms of the government having an impact on the public good over the past 5.5 to 6 years that we're starting to see even hardcore Republicans become disenchanted with what's going on. And I think the aftermath of that disenchantment is always, okay, what do we do now? And I think the Democrats, to some extent or to a great extent, should be saying, well, why don't we get back to tradition? Why don't we go back to America's roots, have some checks and balances, stick up for human rights, stick up for a free press, and reverse the way things have been going for the past 5.5 disastrous years.
God, if they could just talk like that, Jim, if they could just present it, if they could just reframe what the Founding Fathers actually stood for and stand on those principles, they'd actually have a platform, which I think is eluding them at the moment.
That's my feeling exactly. I mean, the platform is there. They just have to reach out and grab it, and I think and use it as a baseball bat.
Well, I hope they do it, and thanks for your great book, and good luck with everything.
Well, thank you, Mark. I really appreciate it.
You take care. That was Jim Norton, or J.R. Norton, as he's known on the cover of his book, Saving General Washington. When we come back, we're going to talk to, is Mortensen next, or are we going to talk about some stuff? Yeah, we'll talk about some stuff, because I got some ideas about some things, and you've got problems, Jim.
He's 100% juice, Mark Maron.
Did you just call me a Jew?
No, I said you're 100% juice.
What does that mean, though? Juice? What does that mean?
No, I'm saying that you're 100%, you're like a box of juicy juice.
Talk about Hitler's testicles yesterday, and now juice? Juice. What do you mean by juice?
No, I'm sorry, man.
You bring up Goebbels and how impressed you are with Joseph Goebbels? Hell are you, Jim Earl? The hell are you?
I didn't mean to imply any of that.
You got relatives who sit with Hitler at dinner? Who are you?
No, they just met him.
What does that even mean? You're just saying met now because you're afraid of the context.
Well, you know, they exchanged advice.
Are you a mole? Are you a agent provocateur? Why are you here, man?
I'm here to keep an eye on you.
Are you an FBI mole?
Your parents sent me.
Huh? Are you an NSA mole? My parents sent
me. Your parents sent me.
Are they sent you together? You mean they're talking to each other?
They want me to keep an eye on you.
Oh,
they're very worried about you.
Come on.
They're very, very worried about
you. I saw
a
movie last night that should make us feel ashamed of ourselves.
Oh.
Ashamed. Man. I saw a movie that we're going to be talking to the director tomorrow, Sam Green, the documentary The Weather Underground about the Weathermen movement.
Oh, I saw that one.
You did see it?
Oh, yeah.
Well, he's going to be in tomorrow. Those guys, I don't know, you know, to even understand the culture of America. That's why, you know, you listen to guys like Malloy and you listen to cats who were around in the late 60s, like, you know, Bill Kohler, I think, was 29 in 69.
Mm-hmm.
And but the entire culture, I mean, we're dealing with a war right now, a guerrilla war, an insurgency, a wrongful war that is plowing forward. And the similarities are there, but the scope of the cultural scope of the Vietnam War and the cultural scope and just the murder and the amount of death and how long it went on for, brain bending. But the reaction of this particular group of radicals that came out of the SDS and just going into the fractioning of the SDS, which was a democratic movement seeking fairly reasonable change, to splinter off and kind of fall apart into the Weathermen Underground, which was a group that went out and bombed places after a few of that. It's what's wild is that townhouse that blew up in New York on 11th Street, where three members of the Weathermen were building bombs to plant at a officer's dance.
Mm-hmm.
In the military. They blew up and killed the three of them. And that was what made the Weathermen realize that they didn't want to kill people. But I remember that townhouse, and I had no idea why it was modern and the rest of them weren't until I saw this thing yesterday. But I think what I'm saying is that when they interviewed some of these guys, and we'll talk to Sam Green about this tomorrow, the commitment and the proximity of Marxist and socialist principles to the underground at that time, that the real enemy was capitalism. Period. I mean, you hear some of that now, but the language is different. You hear corporatocracy. You hear a corporate takeover of our government. You hear opportunistic politicians, cronyism, and all this stuff. But in the 60s, there was no separation between what they were fighting against. They were like, you know, the police are the pigs, and they are operating at behest of a capitalist system that cares not for the people of this country, cares only about greed, and is has no that language does not exist anymore. And on some level, the demonization of socialism and Marxism still exists, because when you talk about national health care, which should be a platform of the Democratic Party, it should exist for all people. The first thing they're going to say is, like, what are you, commies? What are you, a bunch of socialists? Whereas you and I know, you being a progressive of the cantankerous and very committed sort, that if you don't start taking on the very system of capitalism, you're not going to get anywhere. when you talk about progressive nature of taking apart the free trade agreements in order to create some balance economically in countries that are affiliated with each other, you're talking about attacking what has become the global model of capitalism. It is still the enemy, is what I'm saying, and nobody talks about it in those black and white Manichaean terms.
Well, Jim, you know, I don't even think capitalism, real capitalism, is the enemy, because nobody practices real capitalism. That's the problem with this country, is real capitalism has never been given a chance. I mean, you have equal competition. You have real competition. I don't think there's ever been real competition. That's a big problem.
But I think the fallacy of capitalism in general, wow, man, what are we talking about? I think the fallacy of real capitalism in general?
What about China? You think China...
Holy Christ.
I think China is now against socialism and communism, because they're bringing in Google. They're doing everything they can to satisfy their people with money.
But what they did was,
at the price of freedom.
But they're
falling for it.
Yeah, but no. But they're taking a capitalist template. They're taking a capitalist idea and putting on this socialist template. Whereas that's the reason why they can make things so cheap, is that they know how to mobilize hundreds of thousands of their people to manufacture things. They did it for the state.
They're turning themselves into a plutocracy, not unlike the United States is going to be soon.
But I think the biggest problem with the whole competitive idea is that it's, monopolies, and now you have an administration that has completely, facilitated legislation that will protect corporations over individuals, that will not only, endanger individuals in some working situations, but will not rule in the favor of individuals when they have a just fight against a corporation. There's no way to punish corporations anymore with a punishment in terms of money. You can't even sue a corporation anymore for over a certain cap. So they just work it into the bottom line. But what I think is interesting about the youth movement, about the anti-war movement, about everything else, is that in this film that we'll talk to Sam Green about tomorrow, is how everything was intertwined, that the reaction to the Vietnam War was specific and galvanizing. And then in the mid-70s, the left started to break apart and fractionalize into a lot of the groups that exist today. Primarily the one that really took precedent over everything else was the women's movement, and that was important. But some of that fractionalization still exists today, and I think it is some of the reasons why the Democratic Party can't honor its progressive nature, if it really had one, because they're sold out too, and they try to play these fractionalized segments of the left in a very specific way. Because you always have whack jobs like you out on the margin. You can't accommodate you. Democratic Party is not.
I'm just going to gloss over that because I am tolerant. But, we need another genius like Chester A. Arthur to come back.
Chester A. Arthur?
Yeah.
With the same sideburns or without the sideburns? Just
with sideburns.
Uh-huh. What were some of your favorite Chester A. Arthur nuggets?
Why,
big talker.
He abolished cronyism in civil service.
There you go. We do need him. And his sideburns.
Established a meritocracy.
We'll be back with a Democratic strategist, Kirsten Powers.
Coming up next, we're going to laugh at dead people. That's Mort Mortensen's Weekly Remembrance.
And now, he lost a kidney in the Burger Wars. Mark Maron.
Now go get your shine box. How many times a year can I watch that damn movie? Goodfellas. Unbelievable. I'm watching. What the hell's wrong with me? We were just talking about stuff on the break, and I'm coming back into the show, geniuses. Mm. Just rambling on about it. Every week we reflect in our times of sorrow as we look back on the lives of the recently departed. Here now is grief correspondent Mort Mortensen with our weekly remembrance.
Hi.
Wow, you got a real pile of Kleenexes there. It's bad, huh? Allergies. My wife, too. My wife has got them, too.
So, yeah, I know. It's a lot of pollen out this season.
In here, too, there's pollen.
It's almost the beginning of summer.
Oh, yeah.
Lou Anderson, who played Clarabelle the Clown on Howdy Doody.
No.
It's Howdy Daddy time. Lou Anderson, whose mischievous antics has the lovable Clarabelle made an indelible impression on such future clowns as Prince and Courtney Love, is now jamming up in heaven with John Wayne Gacy. Anderson's popular character, Clarabelle, became famous for communicating with people by honking horns and squirting water, two things Anderson started doing again when he turned 80.
I'm here.
What are you looking at?
What time is it?
It's howdy daddy time. Many believe Anderson's portrayal of Clarabelle as a mute was a stroke of comedic genius. But when it comes down to it, it was just the producer's little way of never having to pay scale.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. A distinctive feature of the hit show were the onstage bleachers of 40 kids called the Peanut Gallery. So named because Fear Poop Arcade just didn't seem appropriate. Well, now you're laughing at the poop reference.
Yeah, well, how can you not laugh at poop? It's guaranteed funny.
Anderson requested that he be remembered for a lifetime spent working as a respected and accomplished jazz musician. I don't think that's going to happen.
Do you know any of his records, Lou Anderson?
No, he was a really accomplished jazz musician, though. He spent most of his life arranging and conducting a jazz band.
But I think most of the time people are like, what's the clown doing with the baton?
It's Clarabelle.
Yeah, it's Clarabelle. All right, sorry. Didn't mean to interrupt. You all right?
Yeah, man. Oh, God.
You want to blow your nose?
Hey, thanks a lot, man.
It's dripping a little. Oh, that was good. The little last one was good.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Herbert Ted Doane, last of the Dows.
Really?
Yes. Hmm. Herbert Doane was the last family member to lead Dow Chemical, the world's largest producer of plastics, chemicals, and synthetic rubber. Doane apparently died of asphyxiation after the Dow silly putty he was pleasuring himself with became hopelessly stuck in the tracks of the Dow Ziploc bag he was erotically tightening around his head.
Is that true?
What are you asking me that for?
Get on with it.
Are you asking me these stupid... Jeez, what do you mean, is that true? You think they would let something like that out if it were true?
I don't know. I thought you had a...
Are you an idiot?
Maybe.
Jesus Christ.
All right, get out with the party.
Early in his tenure at Dow Chemical, Doane set the ambitious goal of increasing growth nationwide by 10% per year. Unfortunately, he was talking about tumors.
Yeah.
Founded by his grandfather in 1897 on the principle that the world didn't have enough three-eyed fish, Dow today leaks even more dioxin than those old batteries in Mary Cheney's vibrator.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Nice to bring her into it.
Yeah, thank you.
Out of nowhere. Bam! We're in Lynn Cheney.
Thanks for that positive reinforcement.
Sure.
Over the years, the world's largest producer of fake breasts gave millions to the Saginaw Valley State University, culminating with the erection of the Doane Science Building, made completely out of defective double Ds.
Yeah, sounds funny as a poop joke from the first thing.
Yeah, well, you know, I played more than one type of audience.
I understand. I'm sorry, I don't mean to judge. Stay in it.
Doane requested his body be used to coat Mark Maron's new waffle iron.
Yes. Oh, did they make that?
Yeah, they made the coating, yeah.
They made Teflon?
Yeah, they make all kinds of stuff. Agent Orange. Maybe you ought to coat that with, you know, on your waffle iron. Put a little Agent Orange on there.
Go bang in the morning with my waffles, huh?
Right.
No, that's not napalm. Agent Orange is a defoliant.
It's a defoliant, yeah.
Oh, then the joke didn't work at all.
And your
screwed it all
beard
up.
Would fall off into your waffle mix.
And have horrible disease from, whoa, man, this is going in the garbage.
Takes two to make garbage.
It sure does, apparently.
Yeah. You know what?
What?
This has been this week's Weekly Remembrance. Until next week, this is Mort Mortensen saying, goose chopping onions.
Oh, man, that was great. I'm sorry, Mort. I didn't send Jim back in here, and I didn't mean to mess that up. I hate when I make mistakes like that. You know why?
Hi, Mark.
How you doing, Jim? I was just talking to Mort about how I screwed up his bit and
that's okay.
Mistook Agent Orange for napalm for a second and made a joke that didn't make sense. But you know what I think you got to respect is that we do tape this show, and I'm going to go ahead and leave it on there out of humility.
I know.
I think it's important to show that.
Can I ask you a question? In the first couple of jokes, were you reading something else? Or you just didn't think they were that funny? Because Mort would like to know.
I'll tell you what exactly what happened. I felt bad that I went, no, and I screwed up the first couple lines. And I was sitting there going, how can I bring it back around so he can do It's Howdy Daddy Time, which I did. But you had to bring attention to everything when I was looking out for you after all. Because I wanted to hear you say Howdy Daddy Time. So I was thinking about when would be a good moment to do that. See, ultimately,
yeah.
I felt bad, and I was trying to figure out how I could help your bit. And look what we get. Look what you got, Mr. Insecure Guy. Buzzkill Earl says, "Why was I not paying attention? I was thinking about you."
I'm just asking. I'm reassured by that, and I think we discovered something about ourselves that we didn't know before.
What?
Oh man, don't ask me a question. I don't know the answer to that question. I was just BSing you.
Yesterday, I want to clear something else up. Is that
what's that?
I said beveled. I said I misused the word beveled, and it stuck in my craw. I was talking about having, religion beveled into your head.
Oh.
You don't bevel. Bevel is an angle. It's cutting at an angle. I meant sort of maybe blasted into your head or shoved into your ear, but beveled into your head, it doesn't even make sense. And I'm willing to sort of let that stuff go as poetic justice, and maybe somebody can make sense of it and go, oh, well, maybe it was a mistake, and maybe he meant cut at a right angle into your head or
I have,
cut
I have
at an angle into
confession
your head.
Also.
You weren't listening.
Yesterday. No, yesterday I said DuPont was responsible for Bhopal, and no.
I knew that, but you had it written properly. I didn't know what the hell you were doing.
Union Carbide.
Yeah. Wow, so I'm glad we've made these corrections. That's what, and we do it right on the second hour, not on page 7. When we have a correction to make, Jim Marin and Mark Earl step right up.
We air our dirty laundry.
That's right, because we think that's what human beings should do. When you're wrong, you promptly admit it.
We're not afraid of the truth.
That's right. Man, this is heavy. So we're going to talk to Kirsten Powers about the Democrats doing it.
Now, leotards are back. Mark Maron.
Okay. Thanks, Jim.
You're welcome.
A question we ask on this show often is, what are the Democrats going to do to screw the midterms up? We don't like to play or hate, but occasionally we're a little critical of ourselves. Maybe they won't do it, though. Maybe they won't screw it up. We'll ask our guest. Kirsten Powers is a New York-based Democratic political strategist. She was a Fox News political analyst on the Democratic side, of course. She served in the Clinton administration as a deputy assistant U.S. trade representative for public affairs. She's written for USA Today, Salon, the Huffington Post, and now she's here with us. Hello, Kirsten Powers.
Hello.
Thanks for coming on.
Good to be here.
Well, look, I talked to a lot of people about this, and are they going to mess the midterms up?
Well, I think that's a fear that a lot of people have, especially after all the letdowns of the last two presidential elections where everybody had their hopes up and had them dashed. And so I don't think people want to get their hopes up.
Right.
So what I would say is right now, and I hesitate to say this for the same reason that people are afraid that we're going to screw it up, but certainly it's trending in Democrats' direction. There's
right.
no doubt about that.
Right.
So, it's and sort of overwhelmingly so. And, even had like a Fox poll that came out that had it just, overwhelmingly people saying that they wanted Democrats to control Congress rather than Republicans, like 46-29 or something like that. And
good.
Yeah. So it's that's the same thing that keeps coming up in poll after poll. And of course, President Bush's numbers are extremely low, which makes him less helpful. And he was very, very helpful last time in the last midterm election.
Well, what are you seeing right now? So I know the weird thing is we're self-conscious and we want to make sure that we're probably more accommodating than we need to be as Democrats sometimes. And what are some of the things we need to look out for here as we move towards the midterm elections? I mean, like you just said, that the country seems to be on board. It seems that we can't screw it up, even if we don't have a collective platform or point of view necessarily. But what are some of the things we need to look for? I mean, what issues do you think are they going to use to divide and get people worked up? I mean, they're talking about troop withdrawal. That could be used as a political tool. Yeah.
Well, I mean, what they're doing right now, though, you can already see, they're doing what they always do, which is they're trying to change the topic. And
right.
So, they're making up these. They have these. you know, sort of made-up problems,
okay.
sudden crises. You know, suddenly we have a crisis of gay people getting married. We have to have a constitutional amendment against gay marriage. And suddenly immigration is the biggest problem in the entire world, and the whole country is just going to fall apart if we don't, you know, if we don't kick out 12 million people
right.
Tomorrow, because apparently this is a huge crisis. And so they're starting to, you know, so they're sort of going through these different issues for different reasons. Immigration is more of a, that's something that cuts across Democrats and Republicans. The gay marriage thing is clearly something that's to appease their base. But they're going to start to go through on different issues and try to paint Democrats as, you know, not having a plan, not wanting to solve any problems, and that they're the problem solvers.
Well,
the problem is
yeah.
that they haven't really been able to solve any problems, and everything that's happened on their watch has been bad as far as most Americans are concerned at this point.
Just about everything. There's not anything they can run on. They're just trying to frighten fanatics.
Right, and they're probably, it's unlikely that they're going to pass an immigration bill, which is going to be very, very bad for the Republican Party. It'll be a miracle if they can get an immigration bill. And so that's going to be very, very bad for them. And it's sort of shocking, actually, that they're going to let it happen. But they're so, the Republicans and conservatives are so angry at Bush about immigration.
Yeah, and it's also like, I just don't think that this country is as racist as they're assuming it is. And whatever base they're playing to by creating these fears, I think it's far outnumbered by the potential Latino voting bloc that they're going to be alienating.
Yeah, well, and I also think most people don't realize, I mean, the Senate bill isn't actually that horrible.
Right.
The House bill is what is so
horrible.
And that's why it's going to be so difficult to reconcile them, because the Senate bill is saying, let's have a path to citizenship for people who already live here. The House bill is saying, let's round these people up like criminals, you
yeah.
know, and break up families and send them back to Mexico.
Right.
I mean, that's just not a mainstream point of view.
But they're also trying to have it both ways in terms of politicizing. It's like that thing you wrote about McCain the other day in terms of being heckled at the New School.
Mm-hmm.
Is that he's trying to, you know, why wouldn't he want that? He can go to, he's just, they try to make it, they try to appeal to the broadest number of people by, you know, by selling their soul in a way.
Well, but McCain, I mean, the thing that you're going to see all of them having to do for the presidential candidates is that they can't, their big, McCain's biggest problem and Giuliani's biggest problem is getting out of the primary. So,
right.
McCain doesn't have a problem in terms of his broad appeal.
Right.
There are Democrats who like him. His problem is, how does he get out of those Republican primaries? And so the best way to do it is to start casting himself as this person who the liberals hate. Right.
Right. So he goes and he speaks at Jerry Falwell's college,
right.
and then he goes to the New School in New York,
mm-hmm.
and he's heckled by, you know, liberal kids.
Yeah, of course.
Intentionally, you're saying.
Yes, absolutely. And I saw somewhere today that someone on his staff finally admitted that they knew this was going to happen.
Really?
And yeah, and I can't remember, I saw it in someone else's column, and I'm trying to track down exactly where it was said. But they, yeah, it's odd. I mean, it's really politics 101.
Yeah.
You know, it's just not that difficult. And, oh, and then, you know, he goes and then says, oh, well, the kids at Liberty University are so much more well-behaved than these kids in the, you know, at the New School.
Oh,
I mean, it's just
horrible.
Such a setup.
It's just, it makes me nauseous.
And it's just incredible how people, you know, and then, of course, the conservatives who hate his guts,
yeah.
you know, are now coming to defend him
Ugh.
Because, you know, they hate liberals more than they hate him.
And that's
so
what he wanted.
Just, you know, it's just very obvious what he's doing. And so
yeah.
he's just lining up, you know, trying to get, so he can get through that.
All right, let's talk about some of our people now. And this one, just a yes or no. Do you think Al Gore is going to run?
I can't give a yes or no to that because I really don't. I would like him to.
Right.
I've heard nothing to indicate that he's going to.
Okay, Hillary Clinton, talking about, you know, moving towards the middle and in a non-existent middle. Do you think that she is heading in the right direction with who she's trying to play to and buddying up with Rupert Murdoch and this fundraiser? I mean, what is she trying to do? Do you think she is the Democratic presidential candidate?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
But that's hard to, you know, if Al Gore runs, that completely changes the dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, in terms of the field that exists, she seems to be the person who, you know, is sort of the juggernaut, you
right.
know, if you will. That doesn't mean that it's definitely going to happen, and I wouldn't predict that she's definitely the candidate. But at this point in time, she's the person who, you know, is certainly, I mean, I, you know, every time I log on, there's like 10 Hillary stories. I mean, everybody's just following everything about Hillary and, you know, and just, you know, parsing it from every possible direction. And, you know, she's the she's the one to beat, basically, I think, for the primary.
Okay. Now, just being honest, as a Democratic strategist, do you think she's got, do you think she can be president? I mean, not in terms of if she's capable of it. Do you think she can be voted in as president of the United States?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah.
So now, what about people like some of the Democrats with integrity, like, you know, people like Russ Feingold?
Mm-hmm.
Is he going to be on a ticket? Is he going to be in the game at all, do you think?
I think it's kind of hard to compare a Feingold and a Clinton just because of name recognition.
No, yeah, I know.
Yeah,
but he's going to run.
Yeah, if he runs, I think he'll be taken seriously, and I think that he, you know, he will be, you know, other than Gore, if Gore runs, the only person who was a vocal opponent of the war.
Right.
So he's going to, you know, have that, you know, going for him for sure. But, you know, this is always a hard thing to talk about because I think people think, you know, when you talk about it, it means this is the way I think it should be
versus the way I think it is. Yeah, yeah.
And so it's not so much that I endorse this, but the reality in politics is there are things that really matter. And one of them is money. One of them is name recognition. One of them is having an infrastructure and a team in place. One of them is experience. And,
right.
You know, and so that's why I lean towards Hillary in that sense, because she has all that stuff. Plus, she has the experience in spades. She's campaigned in all of these states in primaries multiple times.
Yeah, I mean, I like her as a politician. Yeah, I'm just curious as to, you know, whether or not she can win the election.
And yeah, the only thing that gives me pause is that she's a woman.
Yeah, well, I think we're ready for that. Thanks a lot for sharing with us,
okay.
Kirsten Powers. I appreciate you being here.
All right, thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
He lost a burger in the kidney wars. Mark Maron.
Hey, buddy.
Hey.
Thanks, man. I don't even know what you said. Turned it off. Turning them off. Whatever your intros and the intros are. But I'm turning. I just shut them out now. That's how. Because we've been working together for a while.
Right.
You know, when people ask in the interview, like, "Hey, you and Jim been working together for like 20 years. Do you still listen to each other?" Nah, I've started. Today was the day. Mark it on your calendar. I've turned you off. I'm shutting you out on the intros. Because,
I know why you're doing that.
Why?
Because so you can have a gift later on in your life when you turn on those archives and you see what I really said to you and you say, oh man, that was great.
Why didn't I appreciate him when he was alive?
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Why did I have to kill him? Why did I kill him?
What's that show, that Dateline show where they trap predators? Have you seen that thing where they trap?
Oh, yeah.
That is like, it's demonic candid camera. It should be Alan Funt, like, hello, surprise, you're a child rapist, and you're under arrest. You're on date. What is that? What is that show called?
I don't know.
You know what I'm talking about,
yeah,
though, right?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about,
yeah. Oh, my God. It's compelling and weird, but it's entrapment. Isn't that entrapment?
Kinda.
And but because they're child molesters, everyone's like, so what if it's entrapment? See, that's a slippery slope when it comes to law. When it comes to people's rights. Hey, you know, it's a child molester. That should count, huh?
That could happen to any one of us.
Yeah. What's going on out there with that clock, huh? Did Bill forget to set the clock? Are we good? Is that right? Where are we at? Yeah, look at that. Look at him acting like, I never make mistakes, dummy. Look at the clock. Yeah, okay, sure. I haven't seen that thing. See, Bill's got he did the rub the nose with the middle finger thing that was popular in the mid-60s when Bill was 29. But look, I am...
He probably has a lot of stories to tell.
I'm sure he does. It's hard to get him out of Bill, though. It's like trying to crack a nut,
Hauling amps for Skynyrd.
Hey, he's dropping some big names around, though. He says he's going to get us. Wynton Marsalis is going to be on the show. And David Crosby and perhaps Graham Nash are going to be right here on our show. Not to mention Elvis. See, I think Bill's got mental problems. I think the Elvis thing was a little, I didn't say anything because he
Elvis
just wanted.
Costello.
When someone works for you, you just want to say, okay, Bill, that's great. Good luck with everything. Here's a pencil. Be careful. But, wow, that was just like a weird, Don Rickles thing. Here's a pencil. Watch yourself. What does that even mean?
Here's a pencil. Take it in. Why don't you put it in the garage for a half hour with a cookie?
What is that show called? Surprise, you're under arrest.
Surprise, you're,
Look, let's talk about some real things. I'm tired about wasting time on this show. I'm tired of it. All right?
Are you going to fight against Iran?
Who?
Bush just said he's going to, we would defend Israel if attacked by Iran.
Oh, my God. That's the beginning of the end. Pat Robertson's jumping up and down. That's it. That's it. That's the beginning of Armageddon right there. First, let's talk about this. I think it's hilarious. Hilarious that House Majority Leader John Boehner told reporters, this is in reference to the FBI went in to Representative William Jefferson, Congressman William Jefferson's office, a Democrat from Louisiana who was being accused, I don't know officially accused, but he's not saying that, of bribery in this fairly convoluted case where he was getting money from a company and supposedly the money was going to bribe a Nigerian official to facilitate business. Okay, but that's not the case. John Boehner, the Republicans, John Boehner, big Denny Hastert, and some of the other cats there, and a couple of Democrats, are getting all pissed off like, hey, wait a minute, can the FBI just come into our house? Into our house? They're a different branch of government. We can't have the judicial branch or you know coming in here and just poking around like that. That's never happened. That's never happened. And they're all upset because they would have... The bottom line is, if it's never happened, why the hell hasn't it happened with the entire list of Republican congressmen? Bob Ney, Jerry Lewis, Duncan Hunter, Virgil Good, Richard Pombo, John Doolittle, Kurt Weldon. What happened to them going into their offices? And these guys are actually guilty of being part of a conspiracy of bribes in this country, not Nigeria. But the reason I think it's funny is that all these Republicans are jumping up and down. It's like, we can't have this precedent set. What if they go through our drawer? It was interesting because you know that the president facilitated this. If you want to talk Rovian, why did they isolate this guy? Out of all the scandal that's going on in the whole damn party, the Republicans, all of a sudden this guy, this Democrat, the only Democrat apparently they could find that might be guilty of something other than saving money in his freezer, they go after this guy. But all these other Republicans, nothing. And now all of a sudden the Republicans are like, hey, maybe this isn't such a good idea, drawing more attention to the fact that this guy is a Democrat trying to make a big case out of this. This has got stinking Rove all over it. This has got Nixon all over it.
Well, maybe it's a matter of national security, Mark. That's why all those other Republicans aren't being...
Come on.
You know, you can't go into their actual house and their offices. It's a matter of national security.
I'm trying to figure out whether I screwed up there. Is the FBI... What branch of government are they under? Are they under the judicial or are they under the executive?
Can we get an intern on that?
It must be judicial. Of course it is. What else would it be?
Judicial? I don't think it's under the judicial because they can't. The judicial decides things.
Yeah, I think it's under the executive branch. It probably says right here in the article, but I haven't done my homework properly. I just wanted to jump up and down about what it means, what it implied to me, and speculate along those lines. This is one of those things that I probably should know but don't because I'm just a regular guy. Now, you were talking about Goebbels, and you were talking
right
about on the break and how much you admire and...
No.
Oh, I misunderstood.
How much I admire the American Experience people for putting on a fine show about Goebbels.
Of course it's the Justice Department. Of course it is. It's the Justice Department, but what does that mean? Go ahead. Yeah, I'm listening. Go
you
ahead.
Said judicial, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, but the Justice Department is under the executive branch. Yeah. Man, I feel stupid.
I don't think it can be under the executive branch because then the president would have control over the FBI, and I don't think the executive is supposed to have control over the FBI.
The more we carry
because
on this conversation.
Because the FBI wouldn't be able to investigate the executive branch.
No, the more we have this conversation, the stupider you and I look, okay? It is the executive branch.
Or,
I'm going to leave it at that. Now you
there's nothing stupid about honesty.
About what? Honestly, being uninformed about things that we should? Go ahead. Talk to me about Goebbels and Rove. I like the
idea.
Okay,
you know, Goebbels and Rove. Well, it was a very enlightening show. Basically, it had diary excerpts from his diary over the years, from the beginning of when he joined the Nazi party to the very end when he, you know, shot himself. But the revealing thing was that he knew what to do with propaganda and how to use audio and video and movie footage to get his message across, and he knew, you know, that was the important thing. That, you know, it just his Rove manipulated the message and the truth with these devices.
Well, he so invented. Goebbels is sort of given credit for inventing modern propaganda, modern, you know, the sort of kind of imperial. Brain-bending propaganda of building things, making things big, using
yeah.
the film, using doublespeak, creating mythologies.
But you know the interesting thing about him? When when underlings in his office were when the war was going badly in Russia and when Berlin was being surrounded, he you know his underlings were sending out these propaganda messages saying, "Hey, everything is okay, everything is going fine, our troops are winning battles left and right," and he did not approve of that. You know, according to his diary entries, he did not approve of telling people, you know, that things were better than they really were.
But that was his private diary entries.